Turn with me to Luke chapter 2. We are at that time of year when we look back on the summer. Labor Day is traditionally a time to make a significant decision. Am I going to labor or am I going to play? My day off, I have to choose. Maybe a combination of one of the two, or rather of both, maybe leaning one way or another. But the decision is mine. I have one last day. Am I going to treasure this as a day of summer play? Or is there just some summer work or fall work I need to catch up on and do? Summer traditionally begins with Memorial Day weekend a few months ago, end of May, and that Monday is a day where there's not much work done. It's playtime. It's the start of summer. Do you remember Memorial Day? Think back for a moment. What'd you do on Memorial Day? Maybe you went on a trip somewhere. Maybe you went fishing. Maybe it was a part of your vacation. Did something with some family, friends, a barbecue. But you likely started into the summer routines and you were ready to go for the summer. If you can think of Memorial Day and Labor Day as fixed points here on your calendar, you could trace summer. What did I do in June, July through August? For some, it was hot days on job sites. Others, it was a time of relaxation away from school. For others, it was during school. For others, it was at a pool, maybe working at a pool or spending time with the kids at a pool. Number of activities. But you can trace summer from Memorial Day to Labor Day. Maybe along the way this summer, you built something. You constructed maybe a part of your home or something in your home, and you had to follow some detailed plans. And those plans had page after page, and you turned the pages, and you saw the project coming together, and now the project is completed, and you can look at the finished product, and you can look back over those instructions and smile with a sense of satisfaction, hopefully, that I can see this came together and this came together and this, and look at this. Maybe it's something much larger than just something you built for your home or in your home. Maybe it was an actual building that you worked on, and you can look and see. I know what the architectural plans were, and now I can see this phase and this phase and this phase, and I can see how it's all unfolded. Now that there's a finished product, I can look back and I can see with clarity what was initially just an outline. What I received in an architectural plan or a plan maybe for a trip or a journey that we had marked out on a map, once we arrived at that destination, I can look back at that map and I can see where I can see the fulfillment and the completion of this. Luke chapter 2, verse 41. Every year, Jesus' parents traveled to Jerusalem for the Passover festival. When he was 12 years old, they went up according to the custom of the festival. After those days were over, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But his parents did not know it. Assuming he was traveling in the party, they went a day's journey. Then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem to search for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple complex, sitting among the teachers, listening to them, and asking them questions. And all those who heard him were astounded at his understanding and his answers. We'll stop there. You know the rest of the story. Jesus' mother is extremely upset. From a human perspective, this just authenticates the Gospels. What parent wouldn't be? What are you doing? Why'd you do this to us? She's mad at him. I had to be in my father's house. this is the frame that Luke is setting up, and we can trace it all the way to where we are in chapter 20 today. Along the way, we have seen Jesus through Luke's lenses in a way that continually reveals him as God's Son, as the final prophet of God, coming to his people and to Jerusalem, and we would expect in fulfillment to the temple, finally making things clear. You could build a project at construction, look at it, look back at the architectural plans and say, now I see it. And along the way, you may have had here and there a perspective of clarity. I can see how this is all coming together. Luke has provided those for us. Some of the texts that we've referred to repeatedly in chapter 4, when he's in Nazareth, verses 17 and 18, and he gets that scroll of Isaiah, Isaiah 61, 1 to 2, and he reads about this prophet, this anointed prophet, who speaks and liberates captives, who notes forgiveness of sin, good news preached to the poor. These kinds of ideas that Jews expected of a Messiah, a special figure who would come. Along the way, Jesus teaches and does miracles. And in chapter 9, verse 51, as we trace through Luke and look back on where we have come, he sets out in a determined fashion for Jerusalem, and he is resolute to get there. In chapter 13, in a matter of debate with the Pharisees who are concerned about Jesus causing an uproar, and they tell him, "Don't you know that Herod is seeking you to destroy you?" And Jesus turns the tables on them and says, "I'm not worried about Herod, I'm worried about people like you, actually. It's not possible for a prophet to die outside of Jerusalem." In other words, people like you, you Jewish religious leaders, especially those in Jerusalem, if you were put on a scale of threat to me with Herod, Herod the Great's son, who ruled in the north for many years, if I had to weigh those out, Jesus said, you're the greater threat. It's not possible for a prophet to die outside of Jerusalem. Because I'm a prophet, you're the greater threat to me. In chapter 19, we finally arrive with Jesus in Jerusalem. And a couple of weeks ago, we followed Jesus' entry and the triumph that the other Gospels write as well. And Jesus on a donkey headed into Jerusalem. And there's great fanfare for him, great praise. But then as he approaches the city, he predicts its destruction. He mourns, like Jeremiah, the loss that is going to come in this place. And it's going to be a final loss. This is going to be it. The enemies of Jerusalem are going to come against them and destroy them. And at the end of chapter 19, what did Jesus do that sort of anticipates that? He went into the temple and he began, sort of in an anticipatory judgment, begins to clear from the inside. He had spoken at the edge of Jerusalem, looking over the city, weeping over it. He'd spoken about their enemies coming against them from the outside in. He goes right after that, right to the heart of Jerusalem, the heart of Judaism, to the temple and begins to clear it out because of the efficiency mechanisms that had developed, especially at times like the Passover, like this, where there were money tables set up in an exchange of money and animals for sacrifices there in the outer courts of the temple. And this became a distraction for any Gentiles or women who would be approaching the temple at that time. Their court now became a place of commerce for the broader community of Jews who were arriving in Jerusalem at this time. And Jesus takes their efficiency mechanisms and throws them over. commercialism no more. My house, Luke 19:46, will be a house of prayer. Quoting from Isaiah 56 and then Jeremiah 7:11, you have made it a den of thieves. This brings us then to the final couple of verses of Luke 19. Read them with me. Every day, Jesus was teaching in the temple complex. The chief priests, the scribes, and the teachers of the people were looking for a way to destroy him, but they could not find a way to do it because all the people were captivated by what they heard. These last couple of verses of Luke 19 establish a framework by which we can understand the last few days of Jesus' life. He's in the temple, he's continuing to teach, and in the midst of that teaching, there's opposition from Jewish leaders, but they are in a conundrum because though Jesus is rising in popularity, they're at a point where they need to put him down. They need to stop this popularity. There's a chance there could be a revolt. This is a time of year that's just a firecracker for Judaism. Hopes of a Messiah coming. The Passover is a time that in Israel's history reflected what event? It's the Exodus. It's when the God of miracles shows up to deliver his people from political leaders like Pharaoh who might oppress them. If you're a Jewish leader and your job is to celebrate your history, but not too much, to make sure that you have people rooted in the law so that you can teach the law and you can maintain control, but don't bring up the hopeful passages of a deliverer who might come with supernatural power to destroy their enemies. Because then there might be a revolt. And Rome has entrusted you with a peace. And Rome doesn't want a revolt. They want peace. So Rome will come and take away you. Jewish leaders are put in this tension at these holidays. They're to celebrate, they're to build these traditions because that reinforces their authority. But if things get... They're like parents planning a child's birthday party. They want some joy for their child, but they don't want craziness. It's where they're at. How do I manage this? How do I celebrate my child and all the fun they could have with keeping my house in one piece? So the events of chapters 20 and 21, we should read as the filling that is the formed out by chapter 19, verses 47 and 48. Here you have a general description of what's going on, and these couple of chapters fill it in. Okay, this here are some examples of this, and we have one here. And what we have here is an opportunity to think about Jesus' goal in the final teachings he gives in Jerusalem, in the temple. And Luke, right at the outset of Jesus as a young man at 12 years old, Luke places him in the temple. He's there teaching. He's asking questions that in the flow of the text, it seems only he can answer. The way that Luke 2 reads there is he's asking questions and they are amazed at his answers to those questions. And now he's here. And along the way, I suggest that one of the themes that we could state as Jesus' goal along the way is to clarify who God is and who he is as God's Son, the sent prophet, anointed of the Spirit to inaugurate the kingdom. This is Jesus' goal, to clarify. I want to think with you about that idea of clarity here in Luke 20 in these first couple of sections. We begin with Jesus interacting with some of these Jewish opponents about the issue of authority. That's what they want to know. Who is behind you? They see Jesus acting this way and they are concerned that there's more than one person involved here. This scheme, the kinds of things he's doing, the hubris to come into the temple, clear it out like this, they are concerned that there's some operating force behind Jesus. He's maybe a delegated figure, but there's some power source behind him, and they want to know what the whole complex. We want to know all that's going on here because Jesus is a threat. He's a threat because of the way the people are admiring him, and therefore he is a threat to the stability that these Jewish leaders love so much, and it's entirely based upon their greed for position and power. That's what's here. They want control. And Jesus answers that problem that they have. Here we have a solution. And he just teases out a parable that explains the history of God's work and echoing Isaiah 5, and a theme that Isaiah spoke, a parable about a vineyard that God had planted and he'd done everything for it, and yet it was unfruitful. And Jesus echoes that here, and it becomes the solution to the lack of clarity in the minds of the Jewish leadership and the people more broadly. The problem, by the time we arrive at Luke 20, is that people still are not seeing clearly. That's the problem that Jesus is fixing. There's still question about who he is, and so he sets out broad categories with this parable, and it leads to a clarifying of roles. Along the way, he establishes again who he is, and he establishes again that these Jewish leaders are like parents trying to control a birthday party where they want to celebrate, but not too much, in the frantic position of a parent in that situation trying to have control, but the stakes are so much higher. Join me then in chapter 20 and notice verses 1 through 8. Notice Jesus as this Passover threat. Luke begins, and you can see even in Luke's language in chapter 1, he's just already beginning to fill in the frame of chapter 19, verses 47 to 48. That's the frame. I'm going to fill it in, and we begin at chapter 20, verse 1. One day, here's the explanation. One day as he was teaching the people in the temple complex and proclaiming the good news. The idea here is temporal. As he's doing this, this scene is going on, and as this is happening, there's an interruption almost. As he's teaching one day, and he's good newsing the people, he's telling them the gospel. That's the idea. It's the good news of his presence. In Luke, the gospel could be explained in different ways, but it certainly has to do with him being sent in fulfillment of Old Testament promises as God's anointed prophet and son. He's teaching about himself. That's the point. For Jesus to gospel people, it's reflexive. It has to be. Does that make sense? So he's talking about himself. He's not just talking about hope, good news, in a benign, general sort of way. It's acute and specific. He's talking about himself. That's the good news. So it's not, don't understand good news here as just what we would celebrate, though it certainly is that. To this audience of Jewish opponents, this is bad news. That's my point. Do you get it? It's not good news because it's Jesus continuing to talk about himself. So it is the good news. It is the gospel. They're not happy about that. Notice then the response. Verse 1, the chief priests and the scribes with the elders. Here at the end of verse 1, there's this triplet of opponents put together. Sometimes Luke will speak of these groups in concert, sometimes alone. But it does seem here that the way these are stacked up leads to the effect upon us that this is a coordinated effort. All together coming to Jesus. Chief priests, scribes, elders. They came up and said to him, and notice the one voiceness about this, verse 2. Tell us by what authority are you doing these things? Who is it, look at this, verse 2, who is it who gave you this authority? It's difficult to know exactly what might be on their minds. Jesus, obviously a powerful figure, some maybe have seen his miracles or heard about them, the kind of teaching on the way to Jericho, a blind man received his sight simply by Jesus saying so, these kinds of effects that Jesus has had, Zacchaeus being converted, maybe that news had spread to them. All of this power of Jesus, and yet they're concerned that there's some operating force behind him. Why would they say that? Think of it this way. If you go to the doctor because you have a headache of some kind, or you have a stomach ache of some kind, some injury, some symptom, that could be caused by any number of factors, the physician may prescribe tests. Let's do some tests to see. Stomach ache, you've tried this, you tried that. Can you go? Well, there's a number of things that could cause a stomach ache. I mean, so many different. So he or she may schedule an MRI. We want to find out the source of this. That's what's going on here. We want to know. We're going to run some tests on you, Jesus. Who's behind you? Is there some power broker here, some group perhaps behind you that would lead you to do this? That may be one of their motives, but Jesus, obviously the sent Son of God, empowered by the Spirit, begins to toy with them a bit. Notice verse 3. I will also ask you a question. Tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? Jesus gets right to the nub of the issue. It's the issue of authority. And his coming, his place in salvation history as the authoritative Son of God, predicted by John. Jesus' use of ideas here and bringing up John the Baptist is purposeful to get to the heart of these leaders and to continue to reveal him within the stream of salvation history, because most people believed John. And what did John speak about? Jesus. Luke chapter 3 is an extensive account of this. So much so that toward the end of Luke 3, people thought that John was the Messiah. And he said, no. One is coming who is greater than I am. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. Jesus gets right to the insecurity of these leaders. Notice the text, verses 5 and 6. They discussed it among themselves. If we say that John's baptism is from heaven, he will say, why didn't you believe him? If it's from God and you're Jewish leaders, why don't you believe? On the other hand, if we say from men, these guys are stuck. Do you recognize this? They are the authorities and Jesus has trapped them. Because of their greed, their clutches on the institutions and the people of Judaism, despite God's truth of what they should be, those helping people, they're stuck. Verse 6, if we say from men, and each of the, Matthew and Mark each bring up the same scenario, and Luke notes that the threat is real, because if the Jewish leadership says, we believe that John's baptism is from men, and the broader populace believes it's from God, how is the broader populace supposed to treat heretical leaders? Notice the text. Stone them! Yeah. If you're a false prophet, stone them! That's what they think. They'll stone us. Verse 6. Because they are convinced that John was a prophet. What's interesting in verses 6 and 7 is Luke's use of language. There are two states of affairs going on. One is a state of knowledge of the people and their persuasion about John. The other is a state of knowledge and understanding of the Jewish leadership. The people are in a state of belief about John, and the Jewish leadership is in a state of confusion about what they should do. There's a state of conviction amongst the people about John and a state of confusion amongst the leaders about what they should do. That's their problem. Their problem is a lack of clarity. Now, all along the way, Luke has recorded that Jesus has taught and acted in such a way that his presence and being are presented with crystal clarity. They don't have it. Why? Because it would compromise their power. There's a sense in which if someone could just look objectively at Jesus and think about Old Testament promises and forth, you probably will conclude that there it is. This is him. And many have along the way. But these leaders recognize that their authority is being challenged by Jesus. That's the issue. So Jesus clears things up a bit. That's the point of the parable of the vineyard owner. And that's often the point of Jesus' parables along the way, isn't it? To make things clear by way of analogy. That's what parables often provide. They set out some similar para alongside of teaching to make plain something that's not quite clear in the audience's mind yet. There needs to be a little adjustment, and hopefully we can get this straight for you. Think of it like this, and that's this parable. Sometimes the parables are a bit vague, and Jesus will clarify them toward the end. Sometimes there's an exact correspondence in Jesus' parables between the players involved, if you will, the characters and the themes he wants to teach. And here, this parable of the vineyard owner sets out some key components of Jesus' ministry along the way and the very history of Judaism. I mentioned earlier that Isaiah chapter 5, Isaiah spoke a theme similar to this parable that God had done for his people. Isaiah chapter 5, just at the outset of Isaiah's ministry, this is the chapter immediately preceding the great call of Isaiah, the holy, holy, holy call that Isaiah sees. Isaiah chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, I will sing about the one I love, a song about my loved one's vineyard. The one I love had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He broke up the soil, cleared it of stones, and planted it with the finest vines. He built a tower in the middle of it, even hewed out a wine press there. He expected it to yield good grapes, but it yielded worthless grapes. Isaiah's extensive description here, this vineyard owner did all that's necessary for produce. All the mechanical arrangements had been made, structurally, this vineyard should have produced. So if it didn't produce, what's the problem? It's the people. So now, Isaiah 5:3, residents of Jerusalem and men of Judah, please judge between me and my vineyard. Now, Isaiah takes up a voice speaking for God. What more could I have done for my vineyard than I did? Why, when I expected a yield of good grapes, did it yield worthless? Now I'll tell you what I'm about to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will tear down its wall, and it will be trampled. I'll make it a wasteland. It won't be pruned or weeded. Thorns and briars will grow up. I'll also give orders to the clouds that rain should not fall on it. What more severe language of judgment could be used? God even controlling the meteorological patterns of weather around the vineyard. And Jesus takes that up. Luke chapter 20, verse 9. Notice the transition from Jesus speaking, I'm not going to tell you by what authority I do these things. The audience is in a state of conviction about John. The leaders are in a state of confusion about what to answer. They recognize who Jesus is, I think to some degree, at least a threat. But they're in a confusion because they're wanting to hold their position. They're afraid to give it up. And what the people, and keeping the people in this state of love of Judaism, but not too much. Just keep the peace here and keep our traditions. This is going to keep us fed. This is going to keep our place and position. So Jesus said, I'm not going to tell you by what authority I do these things. They claim themselves to be authority, and Jesus has no fear of them. But he wants to clarify the matter further. So he began to tell a parable, and it flows right out. Luke's language in verse 9 really implies that we read this as solution to the problem of the lack of clarity in the Jewish leadership. Their lack of clarity, their confusion. Let me see if I can answer it, Jesus says. A man planted a vineyard, verse 9, leased it to tenant farmers, and went away for a long time. This imagery of tenant work Jesus has used previously. Chapter 12, chapter 16, this delegated use of metaphors of a delegated role for someone in a society of agronomy where someone owns some resource and entrusts it to someone else, some stewardship, some management idea. And he brings that up here. And here it's tenant farmers. So this man owns the property. He's concerned about the vineyard. He leases it to tenant farmers, and he's away for a long time. But there's a particular harvest, and he's interested in that old vineyard he planted. Verse 10, at harvest time, he sent a slave to the farmers so they might give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. It's an inquiry. Let's see what this is like. Has this been fruitful? End of verse 10. They beat him. They sent him away empty-handed. Verse 11, he sent yet another slave. They beat that one too. Treated him shamefully. Sent him away. Again, empty-handed. Let's just pause for a moment. If you're a vineyard owner, you send a delegation, get nothing back. What would prompt you to send a second delegation? I mean, there are a number of reasons. Maybe there was miscommunication. Maybe my guy I sent didn't do a good job. I don't know, but I'm still interested in this vineyard, so I'm going to send another delegation. Just sends another delegation. Same result. Owner finds out. At this point, we need to not make too much of this parable, but we do need to ask, don't we? What makes this vineyard so valuable that you're willing to expend human capital to just try to get some of its produce? The owner's in a conundrum. Verse 12, yet he chooses to send a third delegation. And the result? The same. By now, I'm intrigued thinking this particular vineyard must be of some kind of very special interest to the owner. Otherwise, I'd ditch it. You? And look what the owner does. Not just any emissary or representative or delegate this last time, verse 13. He sends his own son. Likely thinking that this is an issue of disrespect on the part of these tenant farmers. They're disrespecting me because I'm just sending these low-level delegates. I'll send my son, member of the family, the heir of all this. I'll send him personally because I want some produce. It's my vineyard. I planted it. Result, verse 14. When the tenant farmers saw him, they discussed it among themselves and said, "This is the heir. Yeah, this is him. Let's kill him. And this will all be ours." They threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. "Therefore, what will the owner of the vineyard do?" Jesus asks the following question. Notice, by the way, in Jesus' use of parables, very frequently they end with a question. It's as if Jesus tells this parable so he can get things tilled up in the mind of an audience to give a question that will reveal what's really inside. "What will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He'll come and destroy those farmers and give the vineyard to others." When they heard this, they said, "No, never." Just a simple analysis of these words stacked up together in phrases and sentences in a simple flow of thought reveals that the spontaneous reaction of this group, the Jewish leadership and likely people around them, are now getting it that Jesus is talking about them, and he is sounding like Isaiah, and he is indicting them. And what is their gut response? No. Because this is a threat to our clutches on this whole institution. They feel the threat that Jesus has just announced to them. Verse 17 introduces the irony. It's obvious at this point what is being revealed here by Jesus in his teaching is everyone's made clear now. Jesus, in his interaction with the Jewish leadership regarding John's baptism, he is revealing who they are. They are greedy and they are clutching their position of authority. And now he's revealing who he is. And he's revealing what's going to happen to him. And the irony is that Jesus is really the authority here. It's obvious as the text progresses. But he's going to be rejected. He's going to allow this to happen. He's going to be cast off, rejected. The stone, he quotes Psalm 118, verse 17, "The stone that the builders rejected, this has become the cornerstone." Jesus sets out an interpretation of Psalm 118 that's entirely different than Judaism understood it. Judaism understood this phrase, generally speaking, to be that the stone is Israel and the builders are the great nations around, Assyrians, Babylonians. The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. That's how God's going to work here. He's going to raise up Israel. He's going to give us power again. And these leaders who've rejected us, they will get theirs. And Jesus turns it all around. The stone isn't Israel anymore, this cornerstone. It's himself being rejected. He's the son sent to the vineyard. These tenant farmers are the Jewish leaders who are going to reject him. And just as Isaiah pronounced judgment, so does Jesus. Verse 18, "Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and if it falls on anyone, it will grind him to powder." What I'm trying to state here is I think that Luke 20, it's an answer to a problem. The problem is a lack of clarity on the part of the Jewish leadership especially, but perhaps people in the temple complex as well. And Jesus is setting everything plain. His teaching is geared toward that. It begins with trying to clarify exactly who these Jewish leaders are. They are greedy power brokers. They are in a state of confusion because of that clutch they have on power. They will not give an answer to Jesus. And so Jesus wants to clarify things a bit more in this parable. And this parable makes clear exactly who he is. And that implicitly gets back to the Jewish leaders. Notice how this parable ends. Luke's commentary, verse 19. Then the scribes and the chief priests look for a way to get their hands on Jesus that very hour because they knew that he had told this parable against them. They've been exposed. Their state of confusion has been magnified. And now they're in a state of ready to be judged. Everything's being clarified. Jesus is setting out who he is, and along the way, we're seeing exactly who these Jewish leaders are. Everything's becoming clear. Luke sets this out even from the earliest days of the life of Jesus. Even there in Luke 2, Jesus, as an adolescent, maybe his first real ministry, there in Jerusalem, asking questions that it seems only he can answer. And along the way, clarity, a little more clarity, a little more clarity. By the time he arrives in Jerusalem, clears out the temple, there's still a lack of clarity on the part of the Jewish leadership especially. And that lack of clarity is because they recognize that to agree about John the Baptist, agree with the crowds they're supposed to be leaders of, to agree with Jesus about what he tells about himself, means that they will lose control. And if push comes to shove, they would rather be in a position of confusion than a position of submission to Jesus. I want to just tease out a few ideas as we can walk away from Luke 20 and think about implications for us today, and especially this issue of authority. All along the way, this theme is just right through these 19 verses, authority. Jesus' authority in the early interaction about John's baptism, this is a battle of authority. Who's in control? Who's the power source? The issue of the parable and the revelatory work of the parable reveals God's authority in Jesus as the sent one. The first idea I want to set is this. Jesus' teaching always threatens lost people. Just always does. It did with these Jews, Jewish leadership. John the Baptist's teaching was threatening. We see this throughout the New Testament. God's authoritative word threatens lost humanity. It does, and we have to just recognize that. But along the way, a part of our evangelistic work is to speak about the sweetness of life we enjoy in submission to God's authority. There is a sense in which God's authority will always threaten people. We can't do anything about that. That's the truth. But I think a part of good evangelism is to recognize that. And as we're scattered about on job sites, in our neighborhoods, as we speak about God and share our lives, that we are able to speak about God's goodness in such a way that there's no better quality of life in terms of relationships, in terms of habits, activities of life, than submission to God and His Word. One of the greatest obstacles to people just at a human level thinking about Christianity is they think it's just going to be no fun, that God's going to take away any real desire of life, they're going to turn into a robot. Part of good evangelism is helping people understand that there's really no better way to live than submission to God's authority. Second, Jesus' authority is demonstrated, as I noted ironically, in his death. This is something we need to help people understand as well. God's authority is a benevolent authority. It's an authority that looks like a cross in an empty tomb. Here's the love of God. His authority over a person's life is expressed in his personal sacrifice for sin and his conquering of it. As we go about our lives and we are talking with people outside about God's authority, let's express the benevolence of this authority expressed in Jesus Christ. God, who did not spare His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how will He not also with Him give us everything? This is a God who is not a benevolent, or rather just a dictator, an ogre. He's a benevolent king. Third is this. Jesus' authority over the church is the basis of our fellowship and our rejoicing. Yesterday afternoon, I had some free time and just sitting down, I wanted to read some, so I was reading Revelation, just the last few chapters, reading through Ezekiel recently in Scripture storyline, and wanted to just think about heaven just in John's view for a few moments. And reading the last part of John, several chapters, just reading through, meditating, and recognize that so often these songs of victory in Revelation are sung by myriads. Sometimes the saints who are in heaven, other figures, but these songs of praise to God, to the Lamb, are expressions of His authority over them. And despite the situation of being cast off right now, despite their present hopelessness, His authority is giving them hope as a group of people together. And John writes this in such a way that his audience is to be affected and understand themselves as singing those songs. That together, in the midst of being cast off, you sing these songs. This is the basis of you being together, and this is your joy forever. Because your king rules over your hard situation, your confusing situation here on earth. Your king rules over that, and you can praise his name. He is the king. He is making things right, and it will all be seen. This binding them together, this is what we have. This is our fellowship, the authority of Jesus. Would you pray with me? Lord, we come to you today rejoicing in your authority, wanting your good name to be known amongst the nations, wanting your power to be displayed, wanting people to be filled with the hope and joy that you have given us as a fellowship. Show your authority through us, Lord. Clarify for the world around us, make all plain who you are and what you've done, even through us. We ask in Christ's name. Amen.